Hi, I'm Angie Brown, and you are listening to the Being Luminary podcast. The podcast where I sit down with everyday, but by no means ordinary thought leaders to talk about being luminary in life and in work. Welcome to this episode of Being Luminary, where today I am joined by Claire Blore, who is a friend and now kind of colleague. And it's really, really lovely to be sitting down and having this conversation. Claire, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thanks for having me on, Angie. I'm Claire, and I'm the Chief Exec of Somerset and Avon Rape and Sexual Abuse Support. And we are a charity based in Avon and Somerset in the southwest of England, supporting those impacted by rape and sexual abuse. And our big vision is to have a life where people are free from sexual violence.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Claire. And how long have you been at SARSIS?
Oh, I've been there 3 years now. Last year feels like such a rise of 3.5 years nearly. It's been a fast year this year.
It was such a strange year, wasn't it, last year? I feel like most people are kind of saying, oh, I don't know how long I've been doing something on the basis of what happened in 2020. But anyway, it's really lovely to be here. And we may or may not touch on some of the work we're doing together. But as you know, I am recording this series of conversations with people who I know and who I respect professionally and who I know are really committed to doing things differently and working in different ways. And just the fact that you're CEO of SARSAS is demonstrative of that commitment. But I am talking about diversity, equity, inclusion in a very kind of loose sense and really starting off by probing a bit, I guess, how issues around diversity, equity and inclusion have manifested in my guest's origin story. So I wonder if you could kind of tell us where you started out and, yeah, where DEI has come up for you.
Well, I am, you might guess from the accent, I'm Irish. I grew up in Dublin, so I was in the city, but there wasn't massive amounts of diversity where I was from, either of ethnic diversity or even in the place where I lived. I'm very lucky from a position of quite middle-class privilege, even around where I was living. And I was certainly raised, I think, at a time where people felt it was almost rude to kind of mention race or difference in any way. So that kind of colorblind mentality and the, like if I had said to my mum, what's that man doing in a wheelchair? It would have been almost shush, not in a bad way. They just grew up thinking actually it was, let's pretend everyone's exactly the same. Let's not recognize any difference. And I think that was where Ireland was at that time. And, you know, from our perspective, Ireland was full of a lot of Irish people. So there wasn't many other people in Ireland to really kind of notice and talk about. So it's really interesting now going back to Dublin, because even in the years before I left Ireland, which I did 15 years ago, there was a huge increase in Nigerian people and Polish people. And now it's become really genuinely more of a multicultural city. So it's so lovely to go back now and see that multiculturalism, but that certainly wasn't there when I was younger. Like my sister-in-law is Chinese and she moves back with my brother to a rural village in Wicklow in Ireland. And that would have been a difficult move, I think, 15 years ago, whereas now it's much less. Difference is much more accepted, thankfully, in Ireland. So yeah, so that was my kind of background. It was very much the colorblind, don't mention difference sort of upbringing, which I think my parents and schools and teachers all thought was the best way to approach diversity and inclusion, was just pretend everything was the same.
Doesn't exist. Don't look over there. Everything's fine.
But yeah, so I think that was for me, that was the kind of moving to London then when I was 23, 24, I was like, wow. I mean, I'd done quite a lot of, I'd been lucky to do traveling and things, but just moving to a city that was so diverse. And in work, I started working I've always worked in charities my whole life. So when I started working, I was working with communities who were marginalized. So I was working with homeless heroin addicts for a long period of time. I was working with the traveling community a lot. So I had kind of started to engage with communities, but it wasn't in my personal life necessarily. It was more in my kind of working life.
So where did you go to university?
I went to University College Dublin. And that was a real thing that happened, actually, is that a lot of our, not all Irish people, but lots of Irish people stayed at home. So I stayed at home and went to uni. So I didn't necessarily have that experience of living on campus or meeting loads of new people. It was still lots of Irish people all together.
And how I always think of Dublin as being quite diverse, but I guess that I'm thinking about Dublin attracting lots of tourists. And so by virtue of the kind of people that arrive, I guess the stag and Hindus is what is in my mind for some reason. that I've seen diversity in Dublin when I went, but I'm from Exeter, so it probably felt even, you know, to me, I guess it felt more diverse in Exeter. So you get to London and you start working and you're suddenly in multicultural London. Did you kind of have any opportunity to reflect on the somewhat monoculture of growing up in Dublin or growing up in Ireland when you were in that phase of your life?
Yeah, I think I started to notice it when I started working in the city after university and working with marginalised communities, and we suddenly saw a huge influx of Nigerians. So there had been a massive open border policy for a long time, and a lot of Nigerian families moved to Ireland, and suddenly it was like, I'm not racist, but except for the Nigerians. And I was like, oh, interesting. We now have someone to be racist about. And turns out maybe Ireland is a little bit less kind of aware of itself. Because I think Ireland had always felt like, and we get this a lot as an Irish person. I love being Irish. You get a lot of, you know, there was a lot of racism against Irish people. It was, you know, it was a marginalized group in other countries. So I think we felt like we were really open until we had lots of other communities in our midst. And that's very generic. I think most people embraced it, but you could start seeing kind of some of the fractures around what does multiculturalism actually mean in practice to me. And I definitely noticed that when I went to London. Like, I hadn't met many people who were identified as obviously identifiable as Muslim, like wearing hijabs, or not many people who were Sikh, who might be wearing, like, you didn't necessarily see those different kind of markers of religion or ethnicity in Ireland. So that was really exciting to see, I think, when I moved to London.
And so you talk about people who are Irish also experiencing their identity being marginalised. Did you ever experience that? Or indeed, have you ever felt like, oh, I'm really incredibly aware of being an outsider in this situation or being remarked upon differently in this situation?
It's a lot of fun and sometimes very lived up stereotypes of Irish people that you do get all the time. Yeah. I mean, I came from a real position of privilege, and so I didn't necessarily feel that outsiderness about being Irish, but it's certainly in some ways, actually, it was when you went to other countries and you felt like part of a club of people who felt more marginalized. So it was almost, for me, it almost experienced itself as a more positive thing. So when I started working in Australia with the Aboriginal community, they were really, once they found out that I wasn't Australian or English, they were very accepting because I was Irish. They're like, you understand, you understand. And obviously nowhere near the experience of First Nations people in Australia, but it's quite an interesting, it has worked for me in quite a positive way in terms of the roles that I've done in the communities I've worked with, because they kind of felt that I will have that understanding. And, you know, you did feel it sometimes in terms of some of the language that people use about Irish people and the way that there's some jokes and things that are made. But it tends to have been, by the time I was growing up, more lighthearted and less intentionally aggressive, I think, than we see now with people when it comes to racism of other cultures. But definitely something that I was aware of, I think. And, you know, I have friends that feel very nationalistic about Ireland and still quite unhappy with the way the Irish have been treated in the past. I don't sort of hold that any longer, but it's interesting to watch with my colleagues as well.
It really struck me when I went to, I did go to Dublin, but I went to a wedding in Galway. It was the last time I was in Ireland, and I was really struck by how people would start singing songs. People started singing songs, and they were obviously kind of anti-English songs, and we're in the pub. And then they'd kind of, a couple of guys sort of said something like, oh, you know, really sorry, don't mean to offend you. And I said, no, it's fine. They were like, but are you even English? And then they thought it was great. They were like, well, I was like, well, I am, yeah. But they thought it was great because I might have been from somewhere other than England, and therefore I could join in solidarity with this kind of anti-English sentiment. But I thought it was quite interesting because it's something that you don't, that runs quite deep, because although you say that people might still tend towards lighthearted jokes about Irishness or people being Irish, there is something a lot deeper, isn't there, that people have had to hold and shoulder and maybe can laugh off now, but that hasn't been at all funny.
I absolutely agree. And I think I've been lucky in that I've been raised with enough privilege to kind of be able to maybe laughed that off more than other people have. And I know that, you know, from my grandparents' generation and things, that was a really serious thing. Mm. Lots of my grandparents, uncles, great uncles had to move to the UK to find work and were treated horrifically badly. So I think there is that. And I definitely see it in Ireland still. And I know my partner's Welsh, but when he comes over, you know, he's quite quick to tell people he's Welsh because the anti-English sentiment is still there. So he's kind of like, hello. Yeah. Okay, you weren't asking, but while I'm working this point, can I mention that I'm Welsh?
I'm just Welsh, I'm just saying.
Welsh here. So there is that. And I do think that's potentially improved. Maybe it's just me. I think I've improved because living in the UK, except in sport, which I have not improved at all. My anti-English sentiment in sport is high. But I think I definitely realised that holding that kind of inbuilt anger about being anti-English was not helpful to me. And I was living in the country and I needed to, you know, appreciate the country and appreciate. And also, you know, even though some of it is in living memory, it's still not this generation's fault.
Yeah, interesting. Really interesting. That, and that's coming up quite a lot in the DEI work that I'm doing at the moment, is that maybe the people around the table are more responsible for what we co-construct moving forward than taking the blame for what has maybe happened before. So that's fascinating to me. Okay, so you arrive in London and you're working in London. I'm really interested in how you, and I don't know where this falls in the chronology, but I'm interested in you working with marginalised communities in particular and through your charities work, and kind of how it ends up that that's what you find yourself doing, I guess. Is that a choice? Do you feel like you've always had this sort of determination to do something in that realm? Yeah. How did you end up there?
So I mean, it's really interesting because I do reflect on this, because I do get asked that quite a bit. It's like, how are you in this role? I'm like, oh, I think they're the best non-choices I ever made sometimes. Like, so I do think that when I was growing up, my kind of formative years in school, my mum was running the Department of Social Welfare in Ireland and really heavily involved, particularly in work with the women's sector and with some of the marginalised communities in Ireland at the time. And that, I think, really influenced me. And then I did quite a bit of volunteering work in school. There was opportunity to do volunteering work. And they kept saying to me, quite engaged. Like, you might find this difficult because you will need to have some form of emotional boundary between you and the work. So I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do it, but I'm also so interested in people's stories. Like, I love talking to people. I love listening to people. And, you know, when I was working in the first job I did out of university, so I went and did social science, which was a theoretical degree. There was no practical in it. So I was qualified to do precisely nothing at the end, which was lovely. So I went to do that. And then one of the homeless agencies took people on as kind of a mix of a volunteer apprentice type role. And so I suddenly found myself working with homeless heroin addicts, but it was like a drop-in coffee shop sort of vibe. So they dropped in, you had chats, you did some support work and signposting places. But it was just chatting to people all day. It was like my dream job. I was like, yeah, no, this is definitely it. This is what I want to do. And just, I think, realizing for me, initially I was like, oh, are they going to take me seriously? Because everyone seemed very cool that I was working with. And I was still, you know, I'm a white middle-class girl from Dublin, and you can't really take that out of me. So I tried to just be myself, and the chats that I had with people where they would take the mick out of me a little bit, but it would be really funny because they're just like, you're just being you, and you do you have any idea? Yeah. I'm like, well, no, tell me, because I don't, but like, I want to understand. Yeah. And that was, it was such a brilliant educational experience for me in terms of learning really about what other people's lives are. And the fact that it's just like, for the grace of God, or whatever words used to describe it, that could be you. I mean, I really realized and identified quite strongly with the fact that like one or two things that happen to people, particularly with homelessness, can change a person's whole life. So, you know, not everyone who's on the street who's homeless, this to me was news, had gotten themselves there. I don't know whether they thought that they had just decided to be homeless, but you could really see that like a couple of small things that happened, or family that you're born into, or whatever, like that's what determines things for a lot of what determines your life course. And that was for me a really important thing to realize. And, you know, this again sounds ridiculous now, but that people are all people. But yeah, so that was it was the best thing.
It doesn't sound ridiculous, actually, Claire. It sounds like it's one of those things that we sort of take for granted because we can say it, but it's not necessarily something that we ever embody or kind of really kind of, you know, put on as a, oh, this is the reality of somebody's life. And I often found that when I was working in education, that kind of say things about families, but actually isn't often until you're in the moment with a family and you're talking about an actual circumstance that's taking place in their life right there that you go, oh, right, yeah, okay, this is what we're talking about. This is your situation. So I do really understand that. And so your mum's an influence then in terms of your work as seeing yourself in the workplace as somebody that works with other people or that helps other people in some way. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. She was doing some really, I mean, she was more on the policy side and the kind of setting public policy around it. And I found that really interesting as well. Mm. And I always thought I'd end up in the kind of public service sphere. But once I started getting into the direct client work and working in charities, I've done charities and social enterprise. I haven't been able to imagine myself anywhere else yet because I love it. Yeah. And I just find it, so fascinating. And it is that thing that, not every day is a joy and rewarding, but it's so much learning from other people. Like I've learned more in the conversations I've had with the women I work with now or on when I've covered a helpline shift or like than you will get in any other newspaper article or anything else. Yeah,
I love it. And what I love about your story about this origin and about you saying, I think you've said about three times, I was very lucky. I was from a middle-class family and I'm a white middle-class woman and, and it's so interesting because the people I speak to always feel like they have to really kind of justify that position when it comes to talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, because we place such a premium on lived experiences of people who come from minoritized backgrounds for good reason. Of course we're trying to decenter ourselves and privilege and all of those things in order to amplify those stories and those narratives. But one thing I say to people when I'm working with them is that it doesn't really matter in the end the lived experience that you bring if from a minoritized group, the level of challenge you had or the level of privilege you had, we none of us get off the hook. We can all do the work. So I think it's really interesting that actually as a consequence of your earlier experiences with seeing your mum doing this work, that this work ends up just becoming a part of what you do in the world, regardless. Yeah. And that I think that's helpful for people to see.
Actually, that was the thing that I learned. So I worked when I moved to, after I was in London, I moved to Australia and spent 10 years there, but I spent a lot of time working with the Aboriginal community in Australia. And that was such an incredible learning curve for me. And they're doing quite a lot of work, and it's actually National Reconciliation Week this week in Australia, and just quite a lot of work on reconciling with the Aboriginal community and how you take responsibility, even if it wasn't you, as you were saying, even if it wasn't you that made the damage, taking responsibility and apologizing, even again, if it wasn't you that did the original damage, just so that you can all move forward, because you have to acknowledge to move forward. And I think part of me saying about being privileged is it took a long time. And I think it's only in the last 5 or 6 years that I properly understood the impact that had had for me as a person. Do you know what I mean? It's like properly got that it is not a meritocracy. What do you say?
Meritocracy.
That's the word. Mm. Thank you. It's not that. And that, I'm a CEO of an organization now. And, I'm quite young to be the CEO of an organization. Mm. I keep telling myself that anyway.
You are.
Thank you. But that doesn't mean that there weren't other people that were as good or better than me that didn't have the same life chances as me. So I guess sometimes I don't want to be overly apologetic for it, but at the same time, I want to recognize it took me a long time to really think about how much that has impacted on my experiences. And it was really like working with Aboriginal young men. I worked with a lot of young men in the community who were going to be the next leaders of that community. And I have I remember it so clearly when it dawned on me, because I was a young lad that we worked with and he had just lost his driver's license, and to hold the job, he was an apprentice, to hold his job, he needed a driver's license. And he came in to tell me about it, and I was about to give him a full lecture, good Irish guilt lecture. And he was like, how many times have you been stopped by the police for checking your phone at traffic lights this month? And I was like, zero times. And he's like, and how many times have you checked your phone at traffic lights this month? And I was like, interesting, probably quite a few times. He's like, I've been checked my phone 3 times and been stopped 3 times. And I was like, wow, it's really like when you start seeing the starkness of it, how it impacts on people you know and care about and in real life times, I was like, it really has had a huge impact on where I get to. So it's things like that really made a difference to me in terms of my understanding.
Yeah, that's so helpfully put, Claire, because what you're doing, which is like the next level of the work almost, is not just identifying how challenging it's been for the other, but actually how privileged we've had, we've had it, if you like, how good it's been for us. Yeah. And that that acceptance that we are where we are as a direct result, as a consequence of structural inequities that keep others down whilst prioritizing out us in many ways, you know, and I'm speaking as a privileged Black woman, I really think you're kind of helpfully identifying for others some of the introspection and some of the kind of reflection that we all need to do on our lives in order to piece together how it is that we end up where we are, how I end up on a Danish island interviewing somebody on Zoom versus doing any number of other things that other Black women are doing because they don't have economic power or any of the other things. So I'm interested in the period that you're talking about in Australia, because you're talking about working with Aboriginal in a charity. Is it a charity that you're working with?
Yes, I work for a youth organisation. And at all, what was fascinating is there was a real push when I was there, it still is, around all organisations having a reconciliation action plan with the communities they were working with. Because what happened is that they'd come in and taken over communities in terms of, and then suddenly funding that was going to Aboriginal First Nations people was then coming to wider organisations to work at them rather than with those communities. So yeah, so that was a really, really interesting piece of work for me and just the relationship with that community. And yeah, amazing.
Can you just check my language for me? Because I said Aboriginal. What's the term? You say Aboriginal First
Nations.
What's the term?
When I've been listening, so when I left, it was Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander people. And then more recently, people are saying First Nations. So I'm not quite sure where language is up to in Australia, but I hear First Nations. I still listen to a lot of Australian podcasts. I hear First Nations coming through more and more. I think probably because it's a bit more inclusive of all the communities that identify as First Communities, the oldest living civilization in the world.
That's really helpful. Thank you. So you're working for this charity, and what I'm really interested in is how diversity, equity, inclusion matters, if you like. How are you able to bring a consciousness of diversity, equity, and inclusion into an organization whose work presumably was all about diversity, equity, inclusion? Like, how do you continue to check yourself, I guess, in that setting in which we could all pat ourselves on the back and say, well, we're doing the work because we're doing the work, because that's what we're doing?
What you need to have is an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community team who are telling you to check yourself. They were, so we, with the Reconciliation Action Plan, we had a group that worked together on it. And so community members, some of our staff who were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, and some of the senior team members and some of the senior staff in the organization, and everything went through that steering group. And we were always in it was really good because it always helped you to check that you weren't being complacent in what you were doing. And there was no room for complacency. And as a community, they are incredibly good at advocating for themselves now and making sure that people are really aware of what's needed to support that community appropriately. Mm-hmm. So I find that brilliant. And we did some incredible training. Like, we had for the whole organization some incredibly deep and meaningful training around what it meant to be a person from the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander community living in Australia when this was your home and we've all come here, and what that means for the land. And it's such a beautiful and incredibly interesting culture. So yeah, so it was amazing. That community group really held you to account, though. And so, you know, if I came with a brilliant idea that I hadn't bothered to sense check with anybody, they would quickly tell me, have you asked anyone if that's what they want? I'd be like, no, but is it not brilliant? They'd be like, nah, it might be, but we haven't asked anyone, so we don't.
Yeah, that's so helpful, because I think that's a lot of what we're grappling with in the UK. I'm watching over this last year, people kind of saying, right, we're going to do this DEI work, and then not really having that who's holding your feet to the fire here moment, the kind of which in schools is kind of is your service user. I know you use the language of service users, but in schools, your parents, your community, the children, the staff, like, how much are they casting their eyes over these great plans that you've got? How much are they saying, this is actually our experience of your organization? And how much are we internalizing that?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the things we did quite well was make sure that we had a lot of feedback. So I think when you're working with children and young people, you can get that from exactly those groups, from parents, from the young people themselves, and from the staff. Like, the staff, we ran an Aboriginal apprenticeship scheme. It was the first one in the area. that really changed our relationship with the community, because until then we were seen as an organization that were taking money from the Black community, whereas then we were finally putting money back into the community by training people up, by offering people ongoing jobs afterwards. And so we went from having like 5%, I think, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander team members to 25% in the space of 3 years of running that apprenticeship. And it was game changing. And the quality of the work we were delivering was game changing as a result, because those young men and women knew the communities and knew what those young men and women coming through those communities needed much better than we, any of us, would have ever been able to.
So after the 10 years in Australia, what happened then?
So I had two lovely babies and decided that I was too far away from all the grandparents, so we would move back to Australia. And I think during that period of being pregnant and having a daughter particularly, my feminism was reignited in terms of just seeing the stats around violence against women and girls and the impact. I mean, there was a great thing in Australia. So there was one, similarly, the statistics are similarly horrific as they are here, that one woman a week is killed by an intimate partner in the UK. And I just remember a woman on the radio saying if there was a similar number of men being killed by sharks in Australia, they would drain the oceans, whereas they were doing nothing. Violence against women and girls. And so I just started to really feel like that was the sector that I wanted to work in. So I came back, and as luck would have it, I mean, I'm really surprised. I rang a friend and was like, do you know what's just happened? I've just been given an interview for this organization that's working with sexual violence. It's like, oh my goodness, you could not have written that, because that's exactly what I wanted to do. And so now, working in Starsis, I came straight back and the first job was Starsis.
Incredible. That's the trail of breadcrumbs, though, that I'm always talking about. You know, people think I'm a little bit out there, a little bit woo and all of that jazz. But that, you know, when you go, right, world, what's needed next? And world kind of says, and pushes you in a sort of direction. And you feel like, oh, I think that's my feminist leanings are being rekindled. And you're kind of picking up on different reports or bits of the news suddenly interest you, and then you're rewriting a job in your mind, and the next thing that happens is that job becomes available. So I always say to people, like, follow your nose with those moments, because they're the really good ones. And you come back and you're working at Sarsis now. I'm interested then, Claire, how have you continued to prioritize diversity, equity, inclusion again in an organization that is designed to right a lot of the social inequities between men and women, and that's like all of the economic power, housing power, all of those things presumably are enmeshed with the lives of the women that you're working with. So how do you center DEI within that?
First thing I did was realize really quickly that I didn't know enough about the lives of the Black community in the UK. So a lot of the reading was about the Aboriginal community or about American Black history, and I knew very little about British Black history. And so I think I was home about a week and someone said, you need to read Renée de Lodge's book and listen to her podcast. And I was like, mind blown. Even though I knew it on some level, but the book and the podcast were just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, excellent. And still available on iTunes if anybody's listening and hasn't.
Yeah. So interesting. I thought the interviews and the podcast were just so incredible. It was really interesting for me because there was a whole section on Black feminism and white feminism and the impact of white feminism on Black women. And so, I just found that was really, really helpful in terms of reminding me about, you know, because the thing with our organization is there is a huge rape and sexual abuse, unfortunately, is everywhere. So, you know, it's 1 in 5 women at least will experience some form of sexual violence, some form of time in their lives. That it's really hard to know how many more women of color may experience sexual violence and how much more vulnerable people may be, because it's women that come forward for services tend to be women that have the social and cultural capital to come forward for services. So, you know, in some of the really minoritized communities or marginalized communities, there may well be a lot more hidden rape and sexual abuse than we can see. And so it was just reminding me when you know, how the white feminist movement maybe hasn't necessarily been as inclusive as it could have been, that maybe some of our service delivery and some of our approaches are very kind of, we come from very feminist culture, but is it a white feminist lens that we're putting on there, and we need to think more intersectionally. Lots of buzzwords coming out now, isn't there? I need to watch my buzzwords.
Well, it's so, I'm a huge kind of, I love talking about intersectionality, because I do think that the multiple identities that people hold do profoundly on their experiences then of navigating institutions generally. And I think without intersectional theory, we can just see that as kind of, oh, Black woman, and instead of really getting the locked in nature of what Black and woman mean together. So I do love that. I was horrified at how we still are seeing these things playing out. So I'm interested in your perspective, Claire, on the horrifying murder of Sarah Everard and the sort of the way that that was handled, I guess, in the media and in the press, and the way that was covered versus similar awful crimes against Black women, you know, including the sisters who had a selfie taken by the police of their dead bodies. You know, how those crimes are treated so differently by the public was the bit, I guess, that really shocked me still. How did you feel in SARS when you're kind of looking at those events unfolding?
I think what's really interesting is, you know, we will see big media events like Sarah Everard, which is dreadful because it's not a big media event, but like when something dreadful happens and it kicks off a big media storm, we'll see that play out in referrals, we'll see it play out in helpline calls, we'll see it play out across the service organization. And it will take a lot of our time and energy to think about it. And then you miss these other dreadful stories. And there is no, I think, you know, it's that, it's the same with all the rape culture, rape myths, that there's, you know, there's a rape victim, which is a gorgeous young white woman, tends to be potentially drunk in a pub. Like, that's how all the media portrays it. That's how everything else portrays it. So when anything does happen to a white woman, everyone's horrified and shocked. When anything happens to a young Black woman or a Black woman or a woman with a disability, we just don't have the same level of engagement. It's almost like people can't identify it with themselves as much. So therefore, it feels other and separate and not as scary, but it's horrifying. And it's one of the things that we are trying to talk to the police and to media colleagues about, in terms of like, how do we talk about incidents of rape and sexual abuse in media? How do we portray them? How can we get people galvanized around all rape and sexual abuse, not just the kind of the, and this sounds dreadful because this is not in any way denigrate the women that have experienced rape and sexual abuse, the white women that have.
Of course.
But we make it kind of an even galvanization. Something that people are only interested in if it's a young, beautiful white woman. It's the same. We did a project on older women last year, and older women did not see themselves anywhere in the media. And we did project deliberately. We tried to show as many ethnicities and tried to show women with disabilities, just so that everyone realizes our service is for everyone. But even our website, we're doing some development of our website at the moment. It is still very. It doesn't show. I don't know that people see themselves yet in our organization. And one of the things that we want to do is help people to see that our service is for you and feel like they're going to be understood and heard from our service. So that's kind of one of the pieces of work we still need to do. And I think in our prevention work, it's something that we need to really loudly call out when the interest and galvanization of the public isn't there for crimes against particular groups of women.
It's a really, really difficult one, isn't it? Because we always feel that there is some sort of hierarchy of oppression. There's some sort of hierarchy of need. And I always have to, you know, really caveat all of this by it's all bad. You know, none of it is good. But in this work, it feels like we're constantly having to say, and this group and this circumstance and this context needs looking at as well. And I know this is slightly, again, kind of off piste maybe, but I know a lot of people who will be listening to this podcast are working in education. And so lots of the school leaders that I'm working with have been really horrified by rape culture in their schools, in their organisations, and are really having to address the fact that they may not have kept women safe, girls safe in their schools, and that they're, again, you know, just thinking about both ends of the age spectrum, has there been a kind of tendency to not believing younger girls or sort of seeing them as participants in the culture? Or I don't know what it is, but do you see anything emerging in your work or anything coming out in terms of referrals or people getting in touch with you?
We've had so many requests for training because we do a lot of healthy relationships and consent training. And we've had so many requests for training in the last couple of months since everything came out and everyone's invited website went up. because I think there is that. I think there's been a real, it's almost been an onus on, like, we teach you what a healthy relationship is. You now have to keep yourself safe. And we don't ask other people to keep themselves safe, but we ask women to keep themselves safe from sexual violence when it's been done to them and they are the victim. So I think that starts quite young in terms of what we're expecting from children and young people. And I think we really have to consider, yes, we should talk about healthy relationships. Yes, we need people to understand what informed consent is, but it shouldn't be on the potential victim or the young woman to keep herself safe. There needs to be, it's the whole thing about holding perpetrators to account, whatever age they are, and thinking, like, holding a light to that rape culture that allows young men and boys think that it's going to be okay to get away with harassing women and abusing women, and really understanding what isn't okay in that space. None of it's good.
Thank you. Can you talk to us a bit about other ways then that you or your amazing team at SARSIS are continuing to centre diversity, equity, inclusion, and what you're doing at the moment with that agenda?
Yeah, so I think we're going to be being luminary. That's what we will be being, which is very exciting. So we're working with you. I think we've done some really good initial training that really makes sure that everyone has a baseline understanding of the impact of racism and what equality, equity, diversity, inclusion is. So we wanted to make sure that everyone had a kind of baseline understanding of the work so that they could really investigate and start thinking about some of their internalized racism, some of their internalized sexism, like all that, like just start thinking about what was going on for them. It has been over the last few years, like finally there's been a light shown to a lot of white people, say, actually, you know what, we are responsible for this. Because again, for so many people in my generation who were raised with that kind of colorblind approach, they've always thought that there's not racist at all, but they haven't realized that they've internalized so much of it, because it is in all, it's in the media, it's in the culture, it's all in there. So it's for us about kind of trying to say to people, it's okay to see that now, and we need to start talking about it and having really deep, meaningful conversations about it and how that might be impacting on the work that we're doing. We're really open to hearing from the team now and learning. So we've got a steering group together, an EDI steering group. That's been really interesting in terms of, you know, we're looking at all the protective characteristics through that group, but we really do want to have a strong focus on anti-racism and ensuring that we reflect the communities that we are there to support. So, you know, we work across Avon and Somerset, some of which is very diverse in Bristol, some of which is very not diverse in Somerset, but want to make sure that for anyone wanting to seek our services, that we are really available to them and that they can see themselves reflected in our organization and feel safe to come to it. So they're kind of the big things. And I think for me, it's about really opening up that conversation. And we started talking a little bit about so much to gain from EDI work, so much to gain, but that there will be loss for people. So one of the things we've done, which is a really small thing, is not to only put jobs out internally, because we're pulling from the same pool of people. So if we keep putting all our roles out internally, then we're only ever going to have the same people, and we don't feel like we've enough diversity in terms of the current staff group. So we need to put roles out externally and internally at the same time, so we've got an opportunity to bring more diversity into the organization, which means that, you know, you're going to be then suddenly competing for roles with a bigger pool of people, and you may not get a role that you might have otherwise gotten had it only been an internal role. So we started talking about, like, you know, where some of the places are that actually it's okay that there is going to be some loss. There's going to be less white women in the organization. There's hopefully going to be more women of color in the organization. You know, we will potentially see changes for ourselves, and that's okay. It's okay to feel a bit like, oh, that's not great for me, but to recognize it still has to happen. So that's been really interesting, I think. And I've loved the response from the team around that, because they were so like, yeah, absolutely. Let's just do that. We'll do that. And, you know, listening to some of the suggestions that you made, Angie, about having Facebook Live events and things, you know, that's really worked well in terms of like trying to engage people who might not otherwise have applied for a role with us, trying to make ourselves more accessible to people in terms of recruitment. And I think we're seeing that some of the people, clients that use our service are also watching some of those. So hopefully they'll see that it's a service that they might want to access. So yeah, I mean, we're excited about the work we're doing and having a real focus on this work, and the Being Luminary sessions we're really excited about, because that's going to give us a really strong 7-session focus.
It certainly will.
Yeah, everyone wants to get their hands in and do something really active. So the training that we had was brilliant, but we hadn't quite worked out how we're going to actively make that live in the organization. So this with you, I think, will really help that.
Great. Sorry about the bells in the background, everybody. I'm going to ask my final question then, just to draw us to a close. I wonder if it's so nice to hear from somebody that's not in the world of education, but I wonder if you could offer some encouragement to people who are feeling leaders. I work with lots of executive leaders and CEOs who are feeling like they want to move this forward, but they're not quite sure what their next steps should or could be. Any words of encouragement, Claire?
Well, I think the thing for me is, you know, we started this like a lot of organizations. We reinvigorated this, I should say, after Black Lives Matter, after the murder of George Floyd. There was so much enthusiasm within our team to do something. So I think your team will probably want to come along with you on this journey. And I think if you're really open and honest about the impacts it will have, but also the opportunities to learn and grow together as an organization and to have some of those difficult conversations in a kind of safe, held space, I think people love it and they're so keen. And it's an extra layer that makes you engaged with your organization and makes you understand that that organization wants to do things that are better for the whole community. So yeah, we're really excited. We want this to be a real core part of what we do. And I think bringing people along with you is the way to get started. And maybe being luminary as well. I'm just saying, that's the way.
You are welcome to just say that. Thank you so
much. Yeah, a baseline of some training for everybody and then doing more coaching, I think is a really good way. So you give everyone something and then you coach particular people within the organization so they can really embed the work is also a really good practical step, because that feels like, for me, it's like, yay, something practical to do. That's great.
Thank you, Claire. It's been so lovely talking to you. And I'm glad that we went down a couple of rabbit holes I wasn't expecting to go down. It's super interesting. And I might ask you to come back and talk to us again a bit more as more and more organizations I work with are also really wanting to tackle sex discrimination and tackle sexual violence in their organisations and are really looking for luminary ways of doing that. And as ever, I feel like it's about asking ourselves better questions as organisations and being prepared to really have conversations about the culture that we've been part of constructing normally and working out how we're going to deconstruct it. So have you back in that guise as well. So if people want to find you, where can they find you on the internet?
They can find Sarsis at our website, www.sarsas.org.uk. I'm on LinkedIn at Claire Bloor. I don't know what it is, but if you look up Sarsis, I'm there on LinkedIn. I'm trying to get better at LinkedIn, so that will be useful if people can help encourage me. And we're on Facebook at Sarsis Support. So our website has all the links to our Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn profiles as well.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you so much, my dear. And
thank you so much.
I will see you very soon, no doubt.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Being Luminary podcast. I would love to hear your thoughts on the podcast, so please do leave us a review. Each month, I will be picking one of our reviewers to get a free laser coaching session as a thank you. And remember, if you know a luminary or an everyday thought leader who would benefit from listening to this podcast or who would love to be featured on the cast, then please do share it with them. This episode was presented by me, Angie Brown. Original music is by Martin Ostwick. The series is edited by Big Tent Media and produced by Emily Crosby Media.